You're listening to the Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse at bellydancegeek.com.
Well, hello, everybody. I'm Nadira Jamal, and welcome to episode 42 of the Belly Dance Geek Clubhouse. If you're as big a geek as I am, you know that 42 is a special number, so the question is, what is the question? If you get that reference, please jump in on the Facebook group and let me know, because I would love to hear it. This episode is sponsored by the DVD Dynamic Zilling for Tribal and Cabaret Belly Dance by Ustadza Azra. You can learn new techniques to spice up your zilling and create dynamic group a cappella numbers. To check that out, you can go to ustadzaazra.com/shop, spelled ustadzaazra.com/shop. The Clubhouse is a place where dancers can get together and geek out on all of those things that are hard to get in classes and on DVDs. If you want help with the what, so things like combinations and choreographies and technique, it's really easy to find resources. But if you're looking for help with the why and the how, so things like musicality, culture, composition, business, professionalism, that can be a little bit harder to find. So every month I interview a different guest expert on a different geeky topic, and we always have time for question and answer so you can geek out too. So if you think that knowledge and creativity go together like chocolate and peanut butter, you are in the right place. My guest tonight is Aisha Azar. Aisha has been active in the Middle Eastern and North African dance scene since 1974. She retired from performance after a 40-year career, but still teaches all over the U.S. and into Canada, and she's considered to have good expertise in Egyptian, Saudi Arabian, and Gulf dances, and also teaches other various dances from the regions where Arab dance is found. You can check her out on Facebook at facebook.com/profile.php ?ID=, and this is going to get a little bit long, but I promise you can find the link in the show notes, 1-0000-620-905-5212. And when you get there, you're going to see her under the name Deborah, so don't be surprised. But please do check her out because she has some great stuff to share. And Aisha today is going to talk to us about why shabi isn't really belly dance, but why it's still important for belly dancers to know. So welcome, Aisha.
Well, thank you. I'm really happy to be here. I appreciate you choosing me to be on the show.
I'm really happy to have you. And while we're at it, let's give a shout out to Shining in Seattle, who recommended and made the introduction for us as well. So
you know,
thank you, Shining, this is a really great idea.
Thank you. And Shining is always kind of pushing me past my little borders of comfort too, and I appreciate it. She's young and she's a beautiful, vibrant dancer. If you ever get a chance to see her, do.
Awesome. Well, Aisha, why don't we start talking about you a little bit. Can you tell us about how you got started in Oriental dance?
Okay, I'm sorry. That was pretty garbled again. I don't know if one of us moved or what happened, but I'm not quite sure what you said.
Can you tell us about how you got started in Oriental dance?
Yes, I can. I used to live in California, and I used to go to Renaissance fairs there. I lived in SoCal, and I lived in Marin above San Francisco when I was in my teens. And I saw dancing at Renaissance fairs, and I really wanted to take classes. But I never really got to take any dance classes until I moved to Washington State. And Jodette Silhi was teaching and performing at the World's Fair in Spokane in 1974, and I got to study with her. And then after that, I just took classes with every teacher who was available to me, and I studied a lot with Badawiya, who was originally from Jordan and was pretty darn famous throughout the United States and, in fact, all over the world in the 1970s and early 80s. She was a beautiful dancer. She was an American Oriental dancer rather than an Egyptian or Lebanese style dancer. But I learned a lot from her about Arabness, which is a really important aspect of my own dancing. I studied with everybody that came down the pike for about 8 years. And then I decided that I wanted to really become proficient in a few styles rather than mediocre in a lot of styles. It was really difficult to find teachers for what I wanted to learn. I wanted to learn Egyptian belly dance and Saudi and Gulf dance. And so I started studying those exclusively, and that was for about 20 years. And then I eventually branched out again and studied some other forms. So I've been dancing since 1974, and I have to say I'm really glad that I've spent my life doing this. It's been really enriching on a lot of levels.
Awesome. And tell us about your interest in shabi in particular. How did that come about?
I have a lot of Arab friends, and I would go to parties, and people would get up and dance, and I would talk to them about it. I asked my Arab friends what kind of dancing this party dancing was, and often the women would say that they were belly dancing, but they always would tend to express, too, that their idea of belly dancing that they do at parties was something different than what I do as a professional dancer. What they were doing, they would basically say, this is just for fun. It's not really belly dancing. It's just what we say. We call it that because we don't have any name that we give it. They were really adamant that there was a difference in skill level, and they also see that what I do on stage is more complicated than what I do even when I'm dancing at a party group with them, because I wanted to dance like them when we were just having a party. I didn't want to dance like a professional dancer. I wanted to learn what they were doing. They tend to choose simpler music, and today some of that music, we refer to it as shabi. I've never heard any of the Arab men that I know refer to the dances that they do at parties as belly dance. They just either call it party dancing, or occasionally they refer to it as beladi. And a few years ago, I had a huge argument about the difference between what was done at parties and what we do on stage with one of the male dancers here in this country. But I honestly have never heard any of the Arab males I know refer to themselves as belly dancers. And we do have people like Tito today who dances in tourist areas and for Westerners. There are exceptions to that rule, but as far as shabi goes, I got interested because I was attending parties where people were getting up and dancing. And even though they don't really call what they do shabi, that's what it actually is.
So that's a great place to start. You know, can you tell us a little bit about what shabi is?
Yes. I'm going to start with a quote from the Yalla Hit List, which is an audio tape that was produced in 1990, some 20 years after shabi began to be recognized as a musical style in Egypt. The liner in the tape says, shabi music is the music of the back streets of Cairo, woeful cries of the mawal, a vocal improvisation, saddening, melancholy hearts with themes never straying too far from the pain, suffering, torture, and betrayal that is life. Lyrics often stray into commentaries on events and social conditions. Singers will gain popularity and attempt to work their way up through weddings and eventually make it in the Arab nightclubs. Pyramids Road is their goal, steamy settings of smoke, haze, and whiskey that open for business in the small hours of the morning. So shabi, it was actually originally a musical form that started with poor people in the cities of Egypt, specifically Cairo. And a lot has changed about shabi since it's got its original start, when it was often banned and not played on radio or accepted by the upper classes. The last 30 years has seen shabi music come into its own. And yes, shabi is a dance. It's the dance of the common people. It's the rock out and party at the club type of dance, or it can be sometimes a choreographed on a video dance. It's what we see at every wedding when people dance in the parking lots in Cairo where their sister or cousin is holding their wedding reception. It's what we see the young guys doing on the boats on the Nile for a little money and perhaps fame. It's what we do when we have a get-together and just get up and dance to our favorite song. The word shabi literally means of the people, and that's what both the music and the dance are about.
And, you know, does shabi mean the same thing everywhere, or does it have a more specific meaning in Egypt versus in other Arab-speaking countries?
Actually, the word shabby is used pretty much all over the Middle East and North Africa. And it refers to a lot of things that are not just dance, anything of the people. But specifically, you will see things like Tunisian shabi is popular music and popular dance in Tunisia. Edwina Nearing did a wonderful series on the Gwazi in Habibi magazine back in the 70s and 80s. And the Gwazi never refer to their dances as Gwazi. They consider that to be kind of a low-class word. But they referred to their own dance as shabi.
All right. Well, we touched on this a little bit, but can you tell us more about, you know, where shabi came from and what its history is?
Yeah, let me find here in my notes where that is. There was a time when we might have had a little trouble explaining that, but I think now, in all honesty, it's safe to say that shabi is its own musical genre. In the 70s, there came to be a change in the popular music in Egypt. There were a lot of people coming in from other places in North Africa because there were people like Gaddafi in Libya who was kicking out artists. And I think some of it has to do with this new infiltration of people that from outside of Egypt itself. But some of the music was called shabi, and also it was referred to as common music. And Philip Sweeney from the Virgin Directory of World Music talked about that. And it's beginning to, you know, the songs were shorter in length. They were less reliant on melody, although words were still important, and they were more repetitive and rhythmic in nature, and it was the music that was being made by the average working class poor young people. The first of the shabi singers to gain recognition was Ahmed Adwaya, and he started life really poor. He was a waiter, and he was singing at the same time, and he eventually went on to work full-time as an entertainer. He became famous for opening his songs with mawal, which is the slow, improvised lament form that's really very old in Arab music. But his mawals were different because they were usually sexually suggestive or suggestive in other ways, and they were usually nonsense phrases rather than, you know, something heartfelt and romantic and... I don't know how to say the word in English. The Arabic word for mawal, the feeling of mawal, is nadar, which is like sad love poetry, kind of, I guess you could say. So anyway, this new shabi music used Egyptian slang in place of the more classical wording, and Ahmed Adwaya's songs and other shabi songs were about poor life in Egypt. They were about the working class. They were about the people who lived on the edges of the society rather than being accepted people in the society. One of his most famous songs was called A Little Child is Lost. And there are people in Cairo who actually, they're called child finders in English, I guess you could say. And these people, they look for children who have been lost or kidnapped. It's really easy to get kidnapped or lost in the cities in Egypt, and it happens a lot, and they actually have people who do this for a living. And so shabi dealt with what the people were really dealing with rather than necessarily only being about romance of some sort. By the late 1980s, Ahmed Adwaya was famous, and he was working in London as well as Cairo. He ran into some trouble because he was in the wrong place with the wrong woman at the wrong time, and he ended up in the hospital, and some people say that he was actually castrated due to fooling around with this wrong woman who happened to be the wife of somebody very prominent. And everybody thought, well, his career is over, he's never going to come back. But in 1990, he did come back with a hit song, Mawal Zaman, which means Mawal of Time. So from the 1970s, when Ahmed Adawiya was famous, Shaabi grew and grew as a style, and the music began to have more and more outside influences. There were Western influences, Nubian, Libyan, other influences. And so the music took on a different kind of life than it started with. It became still about the common folks of Egypt cities, but it also became about other things, too. Shaabi music's gone through a lot of morphing, and the latest thing is electro shaabi or mahraganat, which means festivals in Arabic. And there are a lot of groups now that are very famous that are using electronic concepts layered over the old folkloric rhythms or other old Egyptian concepts in music.
Now, you talked a little bit about, you know, this music being made primarily for
people who are marginalized.
Sorry,
okay, now I can understand you. Can you start over with that question?
Sure. So you talked about this music being made primarily by and about, you know, the urban poor. Was that primarily the audience, or did it have a wider reach in Egypt?
Actually, the original audience was probably the urban poor, but now it's everybody. I mean, it's very, very popular style of music now. There are radio shows that richer kids who can actually afford to get on the radio and stuff, they have radio shows about the music. It kind of has taken off, and you hear it everywhere. It's no longer usually banned unless the lyrics are really, really nasty. You can find it in theaters now, which is something that there's a theater, I can't remember the name of it right now. It's here in my notes somewhere. We'll get to it, I'm sure, sooner or later. But anyway, it's now even seen in theaters. And at first there was some classism about that, but it's getting less and less. Shaabi is becoming a respected art form, which of course will change it again, won't it, as far as the psychology of what shaabi is and what it's for.
And does it mostly appeal to particular age groups or men versus women, or is it more universal in that respect?
I think that it depends on what kind of shaabi you're talking about. As we get into different age groups, I think they prefer different kinds of shaabis. I think it's safe to say that almost anyone who attends a wedding in Egypt these days is the audience for shaabi music and also for the dance. I don't think this is a new trend, as we might believe, considering from what I know, people have been dancing to this kind of music at parties for as long as I've been dancing, and I've been dancing since 1974, so it's been going on for a long time. Anyone who gets up and dances at a party or a gathering or a club is dancing shaabi. It's a party dancing. It has its own meaning and purpose. Like most music, it bonds people who understand it. It's a social thing. Everyone can dance shaabi, and they have, literally forever. The dance has been going on forever. When the guy in the Saidi robe gets up and dances for his friends out in the country, he's really dancing shaabi. He's dancing the dance of the people. When an old woman gets up and dances with her grandchildren and dances old style, she's dancing shaabi. We have just decided in the West what shaabi is. You know, we've decided what it means for us rather than what it means for the people. When people get up and dance at a wedding to music, they're dancing shaabi. When the young kid gets up in Egypt and does some breakdance moves to the latest mahragan music, he's dancing shaabi. It's the dance of the people.
Now, we talked a little bit about weddings. At what other kinds of venues or occasions do we see this music in this dance?
You will see it at any party of any kind. You know, it doesn't matter if you get together with your friends and decide to have some food and get up and dance and gossip about your friends. You'll see it there. You'll see it at weddings. You'll see it at birthday parties. You'll see it in clubs. The tour boats over in Egypt, where they have maybe a belly dancer as the entertainment for the evening. A lot of times, whoever owns the tour boat might hire some young kids to come and dance shaabi on the deck while the people are coming onto the boat. So you see it in a lot of places. You see it in the street. You see it wherever people want to get up and dance.
I'm glad you mentioned the street. I saw some clips from a documentary that was going around on Facebook recently that just had some, you know, like older teenagers in a vacant lot on a street corner, and they were amazing. I think they just had something, you know, on the radio going, and it just looked very natural and very comfortable and fun.
Yes, it does. And the other thing that you'll see, and I loved this when I was in Cairo, a lot of people who are poor, they can't afford to rent a hotel or have a wedding in any kind of house or anything like that. So they rent parking lots, or they have their wedding reception in a parking lot. And so you'll see people out in these parking lots just having a blast, everybody dancing, the band's out there, and everybody's just dancing shabi and having a blast. In fact, shabi is right now a really, really popular form for wedding music because it's cheap. You know, people can afford a shabi band more than they can afford to have like a classical band or whatever, you know. So it's easy to have shabi music at your wedding.
Well, that's a great segue into my next set of questions. Can you tell us about how shabi music differs from the kind of music that we usually see for Rakshasharki?
Yes, let me find where I have that bunch of notes. Okay. I have everything written down, and sometimes I didn't write it down in the right order. Shabi music differs from Rakshagri a lot. Many belly dancers through the years, especially since the late 1950s, have used what we think of as more classical music as their dance mode. Sometimes the music is actually older music that was sung by stars of yesteryear, and sometimes songs were created specifically for certain dancers. The music sung by Umm Kulthum is an example of the former. Songs like Inta Omri, Alf Leila Wa Leila, Lesa Fakir are songs that all serious belly dancers know. And these songs are usually, you know, just the opening of the song is like 8 to 10 minutes long, and there will be a lot of rhythmic and mood changes. Different feelings are created by different instruments, and the pieces are usually very, very rich. They're like this woven tapestry of music with lots of melodies, lots of rhythms, lots of segments that hook one part of the music to the other. There will be taksims, improvisational pieces during it that are bridges between more orchestrated segments. These longest pieces of music are often in ballad form if they have words, and they're referred to as aghani in Arabic, which means just songs. So then there are also songs that are created specifically for certain dancers. Everybody who dances practically knows the song Mashal, composed by Hani Mahenna. The word Mashal, by the way, means torch. And this song was composed by a composer named Hani Mahenna for Najwa Fuad. And it's one of the most famous belly dance songs, and you all know how long the first segment of that song is. For her, that segment that we usually dance to as belly dancers was the opening for her show. And the show, I think, was about an hour and a half long altogether. Where am I here? Okay, so you may or may not have heard the song Soher's Dream. That was written for Soher Zaki. And these songs too have segments, different rhythms, different melodies, evoke different feelings and moods. Often these songs have no words and are very important rhythmically and in melody. The music itself guides how the dancer responds, and the color of the music, the loun is what they call it in Arabic, dictates how the dancer responds both physically and emotionally. The music is really rich rhythmically and melodically, and it's considered an Egyptian style of music. It's called Muzika Sharqiya, which means Oriental music in English. That's my cat. He wants to help. He's really loud. Sorry.
No problem.
he's an old guy, and he just recently lost one of his ears, so we feel really sorry for him. Let me see, where am I here? Oh, yeah. Oriental music was considered to be the popular music of its time. You know, since the 1930s, radio has brought music to the Egyptian people, and they were hearing Umm Kulthum on the radio, another great singer's and composer's work as well. Film also made music popular, and, you know, you saw singers and composers in film, too, like Farid al-Atrash, Abdul Halim Hafiz. These people were seen regularly and heard by the common people. And this is the music that you also saw in all of those movies where they have belly dancers. And, you know, there seemed like there was a belly dancer in every kind of movie in Egypt for a very long time, you know, from the 40s until about the 70s or 80s even. And so belly dance music is different from shabi. Shabi music, on the other hand, deals with very specific and often social themes. During the revolution that was a few years back, songs were very much based in the struggle between the powers in place and the common people. And shabi is really, really reliant on a stable melody and a heavy rhythm. And that is, you know, a continuous rhythm, and it's a continuous melody. It doesn't change a lot, and there's not a lot to actually belly dance to there. It's not that kind of music. Let me see, where am I? There were originally in shabi was a lot of lament about how sad and hard life was, and it still doesn't express a lot of different moods within one song. It's very much about a thing when you're listening to shabi music. It's very much about a feeling. The songs are shorter. They're not really emotionally or musically complex, but they are getting electronically complex. Festivals music is really different from the beginning. Shabi music, as it began to have outside influences, also picked up a lot of stuff from the West. And the dancing that goes to shabi music now is also picking up a lot of Western influence. The new shabi, Mahraganat music, it began as something pretty low class too, and it was much less expensive, as I've said, to hire these kinds of music as wedding entertainment. Most of the time, you're going to find that there are heavily male audiences, even at weddings, for Mahraganat music. It's tough music. It's hardcore sounding to Egyptians. And there are females who dance to it too. YouTube has given many of the young Mahraganat artists a chance at quick fame, and the style is gaining a lot of notoriety and can now be seen in higher class venues like clubs.
Now, you touched a little bit on, you know, some of the political content of the lyrics, and I understand that, you know, kind of double meanings are a common feature. Can you tell us a little bit more about that?
Yes. Depending on what you're listening to exactly, earlier I think the music was definitely more about the struggles of the poor classes in Egypt. And that's what they talked about a lot, you know, our lives are so hard, or we're so in love. And a lot of times there was double entendre. There was also a lot of fun stuff that went on, a lot of sexual innuendo. And then, of course, later on things got political, and when things got political, so did the music. And again, you'll find this sort of double entendre thing. They'll say one thing and it means something more to the people who understand what the music is all about. Anymore, there's less wording when you get into electro shabi. It seems like, you know, there might be a song that has just like one sentence that's repeated over and over and over again. And that sentence has meaning for the people who listen to the music all the time. In some ways, you know, it's kind of like having a secret language that you don't fully understand unless you're part of that particular subculture.
Now that kind of, you know, raises a question of, you know, if we want to be dancing to this music, how can we tell what is and isn't appropriate to you?
You can't always, to tell you the truth. The best thing to do is ask someone who knows. I'm pretty lucky because my best friend is from Saudi Arabia and she's married to an Egyptian gentleman. And so, and throughout my dance life, I've had access to various people from different cultures in the Arab world. And so when I had a question, I would just ask. And I understand that not everybody can do that, but there are some good sites that you can go to get some information. Shira.net, for example, has a lot of information about, she has a lot of lyrics, and she also knows a lot of people who can tell you what songs mean. If you're looking for golf songs and what they mean, Leila Mole and Mark Belhadia are both really good resources for that, and of course K. Hardy Campbell. But there is just, you know, if you can find someone to tell you this is why you can dance to this, or this is why you can't, or this is what the lyrics say, but this is what they mean, you know, because a lot of times you're hearing these words and you're going, okay, tomorrow there will be apricots. That's lovely. Filmishmish. I'm sorry, go ahead.
Oh, okay, the last thing I heard was there will be apricots. I think you popped out for a second.
Oh, okay. So, filmishmish, tomorrow there will be apricots, actually means it's a sarcasm type thing, like, oh, sure, that's going to happen. So, you know, if you understand what the words mean, you still have to also understand what they really mean as opposed to what the literal translation is. You know, so the best thing is if you can find someone to translate the words and tell you what they actually mean. Aside from that, it's just always good to be careful when using music. You know, I've seen people do things like get on stage and dance to a call to prayer, and I'm sure just about everybody's seen something pretty disturbing like that. It's a matter of having as much respect as you can for the culture to not dance to music that you're really not clear about.
Mm-hmm. And if anybody's having trouble finding resources, you know, the internet has more and more every day. And you can't always trust what you read, but you can often, like, get connections to things. So, you know, sometimes I post it on Facebook, hey, you know, does anybody know somebody who can translate this?
Exactly.
And even if they themselves can't do it, they can point you to somebody else. So
exactly.
The downside is that you get a lot of opinions rather than facts. But if you can find your way to a source that you trust, that can be a great resource.
Yes, I really do like Shira.net's website because she really does check her things out. She and I don't always agree on every single detail in life, but I do find that she's really, it means a lot to her to have integrity with what she's doing. So that's a great place to look. Yeah, and almost everybody has somebody that can help you, you know, that like you say, if you have a problem, go to a dance forum and ask people. Don't be afraid to say, I don't know anything about this. I've spent half my career doing that, you know. And it's how I've managed to get a fairly decent education is by saying, yes, I need to know more about this.
Awesome. Well, stepping back to the music a little bit, you know, are there any particular artists or songs that dancers should know about?
I think that there are a lot of artists and songs that we should know about. My favorite shabby artist is an old guy named Sammy Alley. He did a lot of very naughty songs. I love the sound of his voice. I love the way he makes every song sound like it's got, you know, just a little bit off color, no matter what he's singing about. For Mahragan music, today's Shabby Trent, I like the Nachos. They're really fun. You can see them on YouTube. They're young and they're energetic and their videos are fun. I think everybody should own a copy of Street Music of Cairo, which is kind of a compilation of Shabby artists and the music from the late 80s and early 90s, because a lot of their songs are really fun. Sami Ali did the very best version of Tegenin. Do you know who Sahar Hamdi is?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, so you know what a naughty girl she was and how much trouble she got in and what an insane dancer she was. Well, he worked a lot with Sahar Hamdi, and they did Tegenin together, and she ended up in jail eventually. And the song was just banned all over Egypt. You weren't supposed to play it at all. But it is on the Yalla hit list if you can get a copy of that CD, or I'm pretty sure they must make a CD of it. I have it on tape. There's a song called Chocolata that Sami Ali does that's really fun. And my dance company and I was artistic director of a dance company named Baharat for 10 years, and we used to do Chocolata, and we would do it in jeans and white shirts and do crazy things with our hair and put lots of makeup on, and we would do Chocolata mostly as a line dance, but in the middle of the dance, a couple of us would go and get baskets and go out into the audience and give everybody little Dove chocolates, you know, just for something fun to do on stage. So you can take Shabby music can do all kinds of fun things with it. It can be choreographed. It doesn't have to be choreographed. I also like Mafish Sahib, and I don't know how to pronounce the name of the group that does it, but they also are young kids. Mafish Sahib is a song. I like the quality of the electronic voice, and underneath that you hear this very traditional classical background underneath all of the electronic stuff happening on top of this song. I think that you say Shobek Lobik for the group. It's spelled like S-H-O-B-E-I-K, capital L-O-B-E-I-K. And they're young kids who are doing electro shabby, and it's great.
Awesome. Well, is there anything else that you'd like to say about the music before we move on to the features of the dance itself?
I think we've just about covered everything. Maybe people will have questions for me later that I can answer.
Yeah, listeners, if you do have questions, take notes, because we will have some Q&A time at the end. All right. Well, why don't we move on to the dance then? So can you tell us about some of the features of Shabby-style dancing and how that differs from Rakshaki?
Yeah, the musical differences affect and define the differences between the dances as well. There are things other than music, too, that we can explore in order to clearly define these differences. Culturally, these two dances have very different meanings and very different purposes. There's also the matter of one style being acceptable for both genders in certain ways, while in the Egyptian mind, one is definitely women's work, as was explained in depth by writers like Karin van Nieuwkerk, and certainly explained as such to me by my Arab friends. I want to go into depth about meaning and purpose in dance, because in the end, that dance always has a meaning and purpose, and it's always culturally associated. What's the meaning and purpose of Rakshabi? Its meaning and purpose is now and always has been to express the feelings, the thoughts, and the social scene as experienced by the younger, poorer people of the cities of Egypt. This style of music and dance started in Cairo, and although the music has traditionally been heavily male-oriented in what it express, the dance is danced by people of both genders, and I've noticed at parties that I go to that every age group will, you know, occasionally get up and dance. The older ladies tend to be the people who will dance the least, but even they will occasionally get up and do something. So, you know, dancing and singing along with Shabby is part of the fun of it. It's truly a dance of the people. It's a way of expressing that you belong to your social group and you see things through your social group's collective worldview. The dance and the music are part of the experience, too, and the experiment of social rebellion. And that translates across cultures. I think there isn't a teenager in the world or a young person in their 20s in the world who doesn't think about social change and social rebellion, getting out of the old and moving into the new. And that's what Shabby is really all about. The dance and the music are the dance and the music of every man, and they're also a social statement. And that's a totally different purpose than Rakshargi. Rakshargi translates to dance of the East, or non-literally belly dance. And it's not a dance that makes the dancer of the people. You know, she is completely separate from the people on a lot of levels. Its meaning and purpose are entirely different than that of Shabby's. In some ways, the dance does separate her from the common person. On some levels, there's still that social taboo that makes the dancer stand out from the crowd, whether she's wealthy or poor. She stands consistently outside a society that claims her as one of her own on one hand and stigmatizes her work on the other. Culturally, belly dancers are rather like strippers of the West. People want to see them. They might enjoy the show. They may even be friendly or social with them. They may even love them. People loved people like Mae West. You know, people loved some of the more famous strippers, Gypsy Rose Lee. But they don't want their son to marry them. They don't want their daughter to do the work. They don't want their wife or mother to do the work. If you intensify this feeling, you have the cultural issues that surround the belly dancer and belly dance. And another difference is that belly dance started out its life as a stage entertainment and not a folkloric dance. Though movement is, you know, root movement is the same, they came from different places. Rakshabi is it's the consummate modern folkloric dance. And it was developed for the participants anywhere on any dance surface. And belly dance was developed to be seen rather than participated in a lot of ways. And that doesn't matter if you're on the nightclub floor or the theater or at a wedding, whatever. Belly dance is a solo dance performance. It's to be observed. And that's exactly the opposite of Shabby in its natural state. Shabby is a social dance. Shabby would be rather like the Westerner at a club or a party where actual dance skill in any specific dance is not really required. You know, we can all just get out there and rock and roll to the music. And that is what the root of Shabby is, even though it has, you know, taken on a more sophisticated flavor than that. Belly dance is more like the skilled artist sharing art through performance.
And, you know, all of those differences in context and role, you know, do they play out and make the dance different in features as well, in, you know, the moves or the stylization or the persona?
Can you repeat that, please?
Sure. So, you know, we've talked about, you know, the differences in the music and the differences in the purpose and the context are the big drivers of difference. Do you find that the moves or the stylization change because of those things?
I would say that the moves absolutely do change. For one thing, one of the things that happens is belly dance is pretty, you know, you learn how to do certain movements and you learn how to do them with a certain amount of integrity. And there are, for me, what I learned in studying Egyptian belly dance is that there is basically 10 fundamental things that we do, and dancers may do them differently from each other, but you can constantly see those 10 things happening, and you see them happen with a certain amount of integrity. One of the things that you can see is that in shabby dance, there's not the complexity of movement unless somebody's really, really hot and really, really superior at the dance. A lot of times they'll do, for example, big, very sloppy undulation type movements. And these are the people doing the dances. This is not when people like Khalid Saif or Raqia Hassan take the dance to the stage. These guys make it look very complex. Aziza, on the other hand, on stage, does regular street shabby. She's not doing anything spectacular. And she invites people up to dance with her. It's not about her doing shabby. It's about them doing shabby. It's about participation. Anymore, there tends to be a lot of hip-hop dance values in Egyptian shabby. They don't do them like the kids over here will get really technical and really, you know, the movement is just sharp and clean and clear, and that's not the way it's translating in Egypt.
I'm glad that you mentioned hip-hop, because I see so many parallels in, you know, who does it and what the context is and what the content of the music is. So that's always tickled me a little bit.
Okay, I'm sorry. Can you repeat that? I'm sorry, this is so hard.
Sure. No problem. I said I'm glad that you mentioned hip-hop, because I see a lot of parallels in the cultural role and, you know, who's involved in those things. So that idea has always tickled me a little bit.
Yeah, it's you do see it, and you also see how culturally, I honestly feel like dance has a cultural meaning that's different in Egypt than it does here in America. For example, if we take our tribal fusion dancers who are using a lot of breakdance and hip-hop type movements, everything is very clean, everything is very sterile, everything is very concise. It gets over to Egypt and it becomes muddy. It's like it's not about how perfect the movement is. It's about how you feel while you're doing the movement. One of the things that I used to notice with a lot of my Arab girlfriends when we would go shopping is that when I would try on a dress or whatever, no matter how much I loved that dress, if I didn't think I looked wonderful in it, I would not buy that dress. I'd just go, I can't buy this. I love it. But my Egyptian girlfriends didn't have that same inhibition. They would go, I love this dress. And they'd try it on. And no matter what I thought it looked like on them, they could look like, you know, lumpy sausage in it to me. But if they loved the dress, it was not important. What was important was how they felt about the dress. Whereas I'm just going, oh my God, I look like heck in this dress. I can't buy this. They didn't have those kinds of hang-ups about it. And I think that's how it is sometimes with dance too. We're very busy making everything concise. They're very busy enjoying how it feels.
Awesome. Now, you know, how does shabby dance change when it's done in a performance context instead of a social one? I know you've talked a little bit about music videos or dancers putting a shabby piece into an oriental set. How is that done differently?
I think that depends a lot on the individual artist. I may have stated earlier that Raqia Hassan prefers a choreographed piece when she's doing shabby music. And when you see Raqia Hassan do shabby music, it's very complex. It's very, very, very clean and very clear. And it's just got professional written all over it. On the other hand, you see Aziza, and she just gets up and moves around the floor doing simple movements and inviting people to get up and dance with her. When I've danced shabby pieces myself, I've usually turned the dance into a skit for one or more dancers, and it's loosely choreographed with some kind of audience inclusion, because that's how shabby feels to me. It's about participation, not just about observation. There are numerous ways to take shabby to the stage, and you'll also see in videos, if you really, really watch an Egyptian shabby video, I think the first time I saw something that I would refer to as shabby dance in any kind of video was when I watched a little movie called A Saidi at the American University in Cairo. And there is a dance scene in there where a bunch of the college students, you know, the movie is basically about this country bumpkin who ends up at the American University in Cairo, and he wears the wrong clothes and he does everything wrong, and he's kind of an outcast, but eventually he works his way into the hearts of his fellow students. And there is a part in the movie where everybody is up and dancing, and it's definitely a shabby piece, you know, and it's sort of, it looks semi choreographed because, again, there's not that need for Rockette's precision. So a lot of times when I've seen shabby videos, there just isn't that need for Western precision. It's still, an American choreographer might look at it and go, that is so sloppy. I've got to get everybody's arms right, and everybody has to take the same size of step, and everybody has to do this and that, and those costumes have to, you know, they're not like that about it. It's different. It's just more relaxed.
And, you know, when Egyptian belly dancers use a shabby piece in their show, do they tend to treat it respectfully, or, you know, do they ever use it as a way to make fun of people? I asked because when we had Sahar Kent on the call a while back and we were talking about Saidi, one of the things that she mentioned was that some of the dancers in Cairo would do a Saidi piece very respectfully, but sometimes it would reflect kind of like a view of people from that region as like hicks, and that would sometimes play into the dance. Do you find anything like that happening with shabby sets done in Egypt?
Yeah, let's talk about Fifi Abdo for a minute. She, for many years, included shabby segments in her show. And sometimes she would start out her shabby segments by asking people in the audience where they were from. And then she would make a joke about their town or city before getting down to dance to the music. And it's not always, first of all, let's look at the context of respect and shabby. They're kind of counterintuitive in some ways, I guess you could say. It's not necessarily, shabby is not necessarily about respect. A lot of times it's off color, it's rebellious, it's naughty, it's, you know, it's not like they're dancing to serious music. It's like the shabby itself kind of makes fun of things. And so, of course, that would be reflected in the dancing a lot of times. And in the performances. You know, these dancers are doing one and a half, 2 hour performances. And during that time, they want to present a lot of different things. Otherwise, people get bored. I mean, you've been to a belly dance shows here, right, where it's belly dancer after belly dancer after belly dancer. And after a while, it doesn't really matter how good they are because your brain is just saturated with it. And over in the Middle East and in Egypt, the dancers go, okay, well, let's do a variety show rather than doing the same thing for 2 hours. And so they'll have these little shabby pieces, and those pieces bring something different to the stage than belly dance. It's like I was saying earlier, the meaning and purpose are different. Hello, are we still attached?
Yes, we are.
Okay.
All right. Now, you've mentioned a couple of dancers using shabby in their sets. You've mentioned Aziza and Fifi. You mentioned that Rakia Hassan does as well. Are there any other dancers that we should look up if we're looking for examples of belly dancers who use shabby?
I think you could just look about any Egyptian dancer, and she's probably going to be dancing shabby at some time in a show. If you just go to YouTube and say Rak Shabby or shabby dance, chances are you'll find somebody doing shabby. I try to look at the Egyptian dancers because they know it best. And they've been doing it for years and years and years. It's nothing new. It seems like since about the 1990s, Westerners have become very interested in Rakshabi. When Yalla Hit List came out, I guess you could say, is when Western dancers really started getting a handle on it. But there were dancers even here who were doing a little bit of it before then. So basically, just look up Egyptian Shabi dance and you'll find dancers doing it. I think just about everybody does a piece in their show. Salamat, you know the song Salamat, Salamat, Salamat. Never ask me to sing, I'm the world's worst. That song is actually about a guy who has a cold, you know, and all of his neighbors, every time he coughs, go, Salamat, Salamat. And the reason I even know that is because my Saudi girlfriend, her little girl, when she was very small, used to cough on purpose so that we would all yell Salamat at her. And so finally one day, I was listening to the song and I went, Layla, does this song mean the same thing as when we say Salamat to Sara? And she said, yeah, it does. It's about this guy who lives in his apartment and he coughs all the time and his neighbors, he has a cold and his neighbors are yelling at him, Salamat, just like we say God bless you when Americans sneeze. And so, and people dance to that song a lot, don't they? I mean, it's...
Yeah.
I refuse to dance to it because I don't want to dance to a song about a guy coughing, but it's really a popular song at one point in Egypt. You know, people were dancing to it right and left over there, too.
Well, let's take a step back from Egypt and talk about Shabi and dancers here in the West. Now, you mentioned that it first became popular in the 90s. You know, has anything about that changed in the way that, you know, American and other Western dancers engage with Shabi?
I think that it has become, how can I say this exactly? I've noticed that the interest has changed. A lot of dancers here in the West now seem to be using Shabi music instead of belly dance music. And a lot of times, it might be because they're only going to be on stage for 5 minutes. You know, the Egyptian dancer is going to be doing a lot more in an evening than just dancing for 5 minutes. She's going to be dancing maybe for 2 hours. So I think that the hafla thing is a lot more popular than it was in the 90s. People used to do shows, and so there were belly dancers doing 10 and 15 minute shows, and there were nightclub shows that were 30 minutes long, and there just doesn't seem to be a lot of that anymore. And so Shabi pieces a lot of times are about 5 minutes, which is what people who are doing haflas, a lot of times that's what they allot the dancers is 5 minutes. And so I think that's part of why the music has become really popular here in the United States. Also, it is not usually very complex, and so dancers, I don't know how they belly dance to Shabi music, because for me personally, there's not enough there. There's not enough variation in the piece for me to do very much expressing. It's just not fulfilling for me to try to dance belly dance to a Shabi piece, but I see a lot of dancers giving it a shot. So that's kind of what has happened to Shabi in the States. People don't see it as part of a holistic belly dance show. They see it as what they are going to be doing, you know, in the show. So, yeah, I think it's different.
And, you know, why do you feel that it's important for Western belly dancers to learn about Shabi?
First of all, learning about Shabi music and dance and learning about other folkloric forms helps us as dancers to be better educated dancers, and therefore we're better at what we do. Today, I wonder if it's very important to current generations of dancers to be well-rounded in their education, because a lot of them seem severely limited in what they can do as far as producing interesting and informative performances. It's kind of like they don't have well-rounded educations anymore. When I was coming up, if you could not get on stage and, you know, do a variety of dances, you simply were not considered ready to be on stage. And now it seems like people just get into specializing in one thing only. You know, and any audience can only sit through so many belly dances, so many tribal fusion dances or American Oriental dances or whatever before a show becomes terribly repetitive. And one of the things that Shabby does is it gives dancers a chance to change into something different, put on a different kind of music than the audience just heard, and it gives us a chance to meld East and West and take off in a different direction than what's been happening in the show. A good reason to learn Shabby and all the other folk dances that you can learn is because it keeps your performance interesting. And secondly, because we live in the West, we're often dancing for audiences that are not necessarily well acquainted with the cultural context of the dances of the Middle East and North Africa. So as dancers, part of our job is to give our audiences an honest education about what we're presenting. And in order to do this, we have to have a good understanding ourselves and be able to present them with clear definitions of what they're seeing or learning or hearing about. And I think we really owe truth to both our internal and external customers, which means our lay audiences, our belly dance audiences, our students, the people from whom the dances originate and the music, and the dances themselves. We owe honesty and truth and integrity to all of those internal and external customers. And those are the reasons why it's important to learn about Shabby as well as other folkloric dances.
All right. And, you know, if, you know, Westerners who are trained in belly dance want to start performing Shabby, you know, what kinds of things do they need to know or to do?
I think they need to understand that belly dance and Shabby are not the same dance, even though they have things in common. We can make sure that we're doing right by the dance by understanding differences, like I talked about, in meaning and purpose. And meaning and purpose is the total clue about what we're supposed to do with the dance, I think. What is this dance in its cultural context? What is this dance for? What do the people think of it? So studying what Shabby artists themselves are doing and how they are doing it and to what style of music they're dancing really gives us a clue as to what we're supposed to do with the dance. And I think we need to understand that dance is part of a holistic cultural picture. You know, we have to understand why we're doing the dance. I think that helps a lot.
Mm-hmm. And do you have any other tips for using Shabby as part of a belly dance performance? Anything around
yes.
music or costuming or anything else?
Yes, make it very, very different from belly dance. You know, change your costume. You've got on a belly dance costume for Shabby, put on something street inspired. Be energetic and be a little bit crazy with it. It's not a serious dance. That's a really important thing to remember. Even when the subject matter is serious, a lot of times there's a tongue-in-cheek sort of attitude about it. The people who are doing this music are usually young, and so, you know, they have a different slant on it than someone who is older. If you're choreographing, leave room for improvisation in the dance because it's not a tight little contained dance form. It's about breaking the rules. If you can include your audience on some level, that's really great too. You know, like you get them up to dance or throw flowers at them or give them chocolate like we did with Chocolata. You know, in some way, if you can include the audience, you're making Shabby a little bit more authentic.
All right. And is there anything else that you'd like to say about Shabby that we haven't covered yet?
I can't think of anything right off the top of my head. Do you have any more questions that I didn't answer very well or completely?
No, I think we've done a great job so far. So I am going to open us up to questions and answers in a sec. But before we do that, you know, if there's one thing that people take away from this call, you know, one thing that they learn or one thing that they remember, what would you want that to be?
Well, I would like to say that my whole dance career has been about making sure that we keep these dances attached to their culture and their social climate. My message is always, always about understanding the dance as part of a holistic cultural picture. If people get anything out of this interview, I hope they take away that dance belongs to a people and that we need to try our best to understand the dances that we're performing from the point of view of the people.
And if people want to learn more from you, how can they do that?
Well, my email, I'm going to give my email out here because as a retired dancer, I no longer have a website and I don't have a lot of those things that I had when I was still performing. My email is dmajewski@webband.com, webband.com, dmajewski@webband.com. You can contact me anytime there. I'm on Facebook under my given name, which is Deborah Majewski. I still teach all over the country and in Canada, and I would love to teach anywhere in the United States. Anybody who's interested can contact me for a list of workshop topics. And I want to thank you very much, Nadra, for having me. This has been very enjoyable. I was really nervous. I hope I did okay. I'm not used to just talking without seeing people.
No problem. I thought that was great, too.
Thank you.
All right. Well, why don't we go ahead and open this up to question and answer. So if there's anybody who's listening who would like to ask a question or maybe share your favorite tidbit that you picked up or even a shabby song that you particularly like, I would love to hear from you. If you're listening on the webcast, there will be, if you look on the right-hand side of your screen, there's a little speech bubble button. If you click on that, that will give you a little panel where you can type in your message. But if you're calling on Skype or on phone, you can press ** to unmute yourself. And we would love to hear from you. I don't think anybody wants to be the first one.
Maybe they don't have any questions.
No, it's possible. But I would also love to hear if anybody just wants to share their favorite learning or anything else. That would be great, too.
Well, I know that, that shabby is being used a lot here in the United States now, and I think it's a good thing. I really do. It really does give people another way to add interest to their shows.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, I think that's probably it for questions and answers, so we will go ahead and skip that part. Oh, we got one.
All right. Can you hear me?
Yes. Hi there.
Hi, this is Shining. I don't know if you saw it. I put it in like the sidebar there. I was kind of wondering, how would you recommend including male performers into a shabby choreography, since it's done by men and women naturally, I guess? For companies that actually do have male performers, is there a big difference in how you might recommend including them rather than an all-female show?
Well, if I were you, I would go and watch Khaled Saif Shabi and see what he does. That's a great place to start. I would also, I love skits. You know that. You worked with me for a few years, and we, our skits were very, very, went over very, very well. And there's lots of room for doing skit work in Shabi music because it's about stuff. And so, you know, you can include a male. And the dance over there, a lot of times it's a whole room full of males dancing shabby when they're just partying. So there's a million ways to include males. You know, I would love to see a shabby piece to some electro shabby that's Egyptian breakdance and have guys do something like Little Competition, for example. I think something like that would be fun. Or, like I said, go in and watch Khaled Saif Shabi, and he does a wonderful shabby with a woman. I can't remember where the show is, but the video is pretty nice, and it also really accentuates what breakdance looks like when you do it in Egypt rather than here.
Cool, thanks.
Hey, and thanks for the question, Shining. And thanks for letting me know that you typed it in, because it turns out I had to scroll down, which I wasn't doing. We also have a question from Josephine, who is asking, can you recommend any teachers, either online, in person, or DVD?
I don't know who's really teaching Shabby in the United States. I tend to stick with Egyptian teachers anymore when I'm doing anything, so I don't really know. I don't even know who you can ask, but I bet you could go online to any of the belly dance forums and ask there, and you could find who's teaching. And again, I can't say what the quality of their teaching might be, but there's got to be some people out there who are teaching good Shabby.
Mm-hmm. I know that Shahrazad in Baltimore made a DVD recently. I haven't seen it, and I haven't seen her do Shabby, so I can't comment on it. But I've been really, really impressed with her dancing in other genres, so that might be worth checking out.
So, yeah, that sounds like it might be worth checking out.
Awesome.
I really kind of, I hate to say this because I also have a DVD on the market, but I don't recommend starting out learning things on DVD. And the reason is because there's nobody there to say you need to do this differently or that's perfect or to give you any feedback about what you're doing. So if you can find a live teacher first, that would be ideal. And that's no matter what kind of dance you're learning.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. Oh, you know, if I can actually give another shout out there. There's also a lady in Vancouver, Canada, named Hiba, who is going to be one of our guests in upcoming months.
Cool.
And I've seen her do Shabby. She's Iraqi-born, but she's Canadian. And she is an absolutely lovely dancer. She's really got a great feeling.
I've heard wonderful things about Hiba.
Yeah.
So that sounds ideal.
Awesome. All right. Does anybody else have any more questions? Anything else anybody would like to say? All right. I think we will. Oh, Shining says thank you.
Thank you so much. I've really enjoyed myself, and I'm sorry about the technical difficulties. I don't know what caused them, but in any case, you know, anybody can get a hold of me anytime about anything they want to through my email or through Facebook.
All right. Well, thank you, Aisha.
Thank you, Nadra.
All right. And I'd like to give another thanks to our sponsor, Ustadza Azra. So remember that if you'd like to learn some new techniques for your zilling or for group a cappella numbers, she's got a DVD, Dynamic Zilling for Tribal and Cavalry Belly Dance, that you can find at ustadzaazra.com/shop. And thank you, everybody, for coming. This is the end of our call, but that doesn't mean that the conversation has to end. We've got a private Facebook group just for Clubhouse members, so if you'd like to share any resources or video clips or ask some more questions, we'd love to hear from you. I'll be sending out an email shortly with an invitation to the group, but just to make sure that it stays all dancers, I do have to approve your application, not your application. I have to approve before you can start posting and accessing the group. So if you do join, don't worry if there's a delay of a day or so before you can start accessing that. I'll also include a link to the call recording and some of the resources that Aisha has mentioned. And I'll also be including a link to our feedback survey. So if you have any topics or speakers that you'd like to recommend, which is how we got this episode in the first place, or if there are any other improvements that you'd like to recommend, I would love to hear from you. Our next call has not been scheduled yet, but we're going to be looking at sometime in October, so please keep an eye on your inbox. And the last thing I'd like to say is that this is the come on in kind of clubhouse, not the no boys allowed kind. So if you know anybody who would like to join us, you can invite them to do so at bellydancegeek.com/clubhouse. And until next time, happy dancing. Good night, everybody.
Good night. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thanks for listening. For more geektacular resources, check out bellydancegeek.com.